Welcome to the Lost Together podcast. First, let's meet the host. Matt Wardlaw has been interviewing, writing, and talking about music in print and on the radio for over 20 years. The Lost Together podcast features in-depth discussion and debate with special guest contributors and also conversations with artists, producers, and music industry professionals. New and classic artists join us to share stories and insights regarding their musical process. Let's get started.
Welcome to the podcast, everybody. This week, my guest is singer-songwriter Steve Pultz. I'm guessing that you've heard his music at least once. He co-wrote Jules, You Were Meant For Me, which of course got a boatload of radio airplay when it was released in the mid-90s, and it continues to get played on radio stations all over the place to this day. Steve first landed on my radar in the early 90s when he was a member of the San Diego-based band The Rugburns, who got some minor radio play in some markets with their single Hitchhiker Joe. Cleveland was a big market for the Rugburns. They got a lot of airplay here, and I honestly wasn't a huge fan of Hitchhiker Joe, and I don't know that I would have gone to see the Rugburns, who frequently played shows here in the area. Thankfully, I had a friend who was a big fan, and he told me, you've got to go see these guys. They were doing a residency at the Euclid Tavern, and I went to the show and watched over 2 hours of music from Steve and the Rugburns, and they were still going strong, starting a third set at the time we decided to go home that night. They would later play direct support at a radio festival here in Cleveland, opening for the Ramones, opening two shows, and if you've ever had the chance to see the Rugburns, it's not surprising to learn that they were able to hold their own in that tough opening slot. We talk about that during this interview. Steve's most recent album, The Accident, was released in 2014, and at that time he called it, quote, a loud rock record, hearkening back to my Rugburns days. He's about to release a new record. In fact, you can get it right now. It's called Folk Singer. He's going to have it on sale at his current tour dates, and he told us that he's going to be putting it up for sale at his website soon as well. The tour dates, including a show here in Cleveland on February 10th at the Music Box Supper Club, are going to feature Steve paired with fellow 90s troubadour Grant Lee Phillips. The tour began this past week, and it runs through mid-February. You can find the rundown on tour dates at Steve's website at Pultz.com. Before we dive into this interview with Steve, I'll remind you that you can visit our website at losttogetherpod.com for an archive of all the episodes that we've done so far, plus show notes for each episode, and there's a variety of ways that you can listen there, including links to our RSS and iTunes feeds. We're on Twitter and Facebook. Just visit us at losttogetherpod, both places, to interact with us, or you can just hit the website and send us an email. Now let's get into this week's interview. Right around the time that Steve picked up the phone, we started having a conversation about a lot of random Cleveland stuff, including Johnny Manziel, and that's where we start, on the heels of that Manziel chatter, as Steve is expressing his gratitude that he's not an NFL quarterback.
I'm glad I was never a professional quarterback in the NFL back in the days when I was partying. That would have made Manziel look like an altar boy.
Right.
I mean, like, honestly, like, you can't do anything nowadays. Back in the old days, Joe Namath could go out drinking, have a lot of fun, playing with casinos, and the press wasn't reporting on that. Nowadays, with the 24-hour news cycle and everybody's got a phone and a video, you can't do anything.
Well, I think even when you were coming out with, like, the Rugburns and stuff, I mean, that was still a time where, obviously, everything didn't wind up on YouTube, because YouTube didn't exist, and camera phones, or video phones didn't really exist.
And if somebody did video it, they'd be like, who am I going to show it to? I videoed it, but...
Yeah,
where am I going to put it? We got away with murder back then. Like, literally, we used to go through towns and just kill people. The Rugburns.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Just bury them. It was like our thing. No big deal.
Well, I mean, obviously, you know,
Black towns can't kill people anymore.
Yeah.
This is the greatest interview ever.
That's the typical Steve.
That should be the poll quote.
Yeah.
Rock bands can't kill people anymore. The music business sucks. You can't murder anybody as easy as you used to be able to.
Tell you what, in that way, the business has really gone downhill. It's a shame when you can't just take people out.
Yeah. Can't go to a Cracker Barrel and just make someone disappear. We used to go to the Cracker Barrel and the Rugburns, and I had this thing, and I would see how long I could get away with it. and I would go back into the kitchen and act like I was a manager visiting from another Cracker Barrel. But I'd be dressed like a rug burn, like in some thrift store clothes. And people would be like, why is this guy back there? But I would tell the rest of the band, it's all in how you carry yourself. So if you go back and just start asking people, are you guys going to be at the meeting next week? And is everybody coming? I need to know, and I need to get a head count. And people are like, who the fuck is this guy? But he's saying with authority, but he looks homeless. And I would see how long until they kicked me out of the kitchen. And if I could find the microphone and make an announcement.
That's pretty funny.
And I was really good at it because of the way I would just go in and have a, it's all in how you just go in and start taking control.
Yeah. Act like you belong.
Because it doesn't add up.
Yeah, I'm sure you could write a book about your experiences over the years just from the rug burns years.
Oh, yeah. I remember one time we came up with this whole thing that had never happened, and we called it Barn Fest. And we said, we would tell people on the road that a barn burnt down and we were trying to raise money for people in town. I would talk about it on stage, and I think I talked about it on the mic at Cracker Barrel once. And I said we were taking donations, and we would say, like, for the O'Malley's barn that burned down, and we're making a quilt, and the quilt is going to show the barn on fire. It's going to be really representative of what happened with the family running out with one of the kids on fire and their hair on fire and they're shrieking and their faces are in horror. But we're getting this quilt built. And I would, like, rush over the parts that said the people's faces are in horror and they're on fire. Like, why would somebody want that quilt? And I'd say, and we got Willie Nelson playing it and a lot of different people. It's called Barn Fest. And I think we got John Mellencamp. And people just look like, are you out of your fucking mind? But I would not laugh and just talk about it. And I think I only got like 3 sentences into the Cracker Barrel once. I picked up the announcement phone, started talking about Barn Fest. Oh, man.
Did you have touring experience before going out with the Rug Burns, or is that where you guys had collectively all your first experience on the road?
When we started, we didn't tour at all.
Yeah, right.
We just played at an Irish pub, and then I remember the very first tour I went on was up to San Francisco and back, and it wasn't with the Rug Burns. It was, we were playing as the Rug Burns, but we'd never toured yet, and this guy who was a DJ wanted to take singer-songwriters, and he had like 5 shows booked. He took me and Gregory Page and this hard rock band called Bad Mood Zeus from San Diego, and I think one other guy, and we all loaded in this car. And to this day, I've never forgotten it, because he drove us up the coast, and I was like, this is what I want to do. Like, and the shows were, like, horrible. Like, looking back now, like, nothing was planned, and I think on one of them, club didn't even know we were booked, and then we asked people if we could just play in their garage. We just didn't care. We were so happy to just be playing outside of San Diego. And when I came back, I was like, I went on tour. I remember I told people that. I really milked it. I mean, we only got like 5 days or 6 days, and I remember going to a cock house. Just got back from tour. Like, but was serious about it. And then, like, that's how much I wanted to do it. And then I remember after that, this guy came through town, and he was in a van, and he played at a place called Megalopolis. And then he was my hero, because he had booked his own tour and was living in his van. And I remember he was on the same bill as the Rug Burns. We were an acoustic duo. And I'll never forget this guy's name. It's Breck Allen. And I said, hey, man, I know you're sleeping in your van, but do you want to come sleep at my house tonight? You'll have a shower and stuff. And he goes, well, I'll come to your house and I'll sleep in my van outside your house. But if I could use your shower, that'd be cool. I go, yeah. So he comes over, and we ended up talking till like 6 a.m. And I was just like, I want to know everything. And he had this tour booklet, how he booked the gigs, what he did. And I must have asked him 100 questions. What's it like being on tour? And this is like years ago in the 80s. And then you know, he finally went to sleep in his van, woke up, we had breakfast. And I swear to you, to this day, this is like 30 years ago, this guy is still my friend. And now he lives in Nashville, and he laughs so hard about that night because he doesn't tour at all anymore. And he goes, you know, I thought you were kind of crazy, and all you want to do is talk about touring, but since then, that's all you've done. And he goes, and I can see why it all adds up. It would be like if Steve Jobs got to go, like when he got to go work on at computers on Stanford when he was just a young kid with Wozniak.
Right.
Like, that was all I wanted to do. And so that's why I'm still friends with the guy. We laugh about it. But and so then after that, we started touring. And one of the first cities we went to was Cleveland. And that's why I've always loved Cleveland, because for some reason, WMMS, I think that's the name of them, the Buzzard.
Yep.
A radio station there started playing Hitchhiker Joe. And I was like, what? And we would tell people, we're big in San Diego and Cleveland and Baton Rouge, Louisiana, because Baton Rouge started playing this. But Cleveland, we were big in Cleveland. As far as I was concerned, we were rock stars. Like, we got flown out, and I can't remember who owned the Agora. It was the LeConte family, I think. And they picked us up in a limousine. Henry LeConte, I think, was his name. And I remember they picked us up in a limo, and we played the Agora Theater. And then we played Buzzard Fest. We got to open for the Ramones. And then we had a residency at the Euclid Tavern. And that was like the greatest days of our life. I remember we played with a band called Deaf Children at Play. Mm-hmm. And another band called Medicine Show. And Cleveland sort of adopted us. And we were like, we did really well. And our favorite place to play was the Euclid Tavern. It was just a really cool bar, and the shows there were insane. And so I've always had like this really soft spot for Cleveland, because it was like the first, they were early adopters.
Yeah. And that was one of the, first Rugburn shows that I saw was, I think, during that residency at the Euclid Tavern. And like, I had a friend that was like, wait a second, you haven't seen these guys live yet? He's like, you know, oh, well, you know, they're playing whatever day it was. He's like, you have to go see this show. And it's like, you walk in and it was like, holy crap. Like, I mean, it's a show you don't forget.
Yeah. I remember I brought Jewel out. She was my girlfriend back then. And
yeah.
I was like, fly to Cleveland with me. I brought her out on stage, and I remember people were like, you know, she was dressed in something nice and she was hot. And you know how Cleveland is. Everybody's drinking, and it's a Rugburn show. They want to hear Dick's Automotive, and she comes out. And I go, this is my girlfriend. Her name's Jewel. She's going to be big one day. And people are just going, show us your tits. And she's laughing, and I was like, you watch. I promise you, she's going to be big. And that was one of the first places she played.
Fans are going to be excited to hear that you've got a bunch of tour dates on deck with Grant Lee Phillips. And I wondered how you guys know each other and how these tour dates came together.
We're both booked by the same booking agent, Fleming Artists, out of Ann Arbor, Michigan. And so they're out of Ann Arbor, and they booked Ani DeFranco, and they have a really cool roster. And so we both have the same agent. And he texted me and was like, what do you think about doing this? Because we did a tour last year. He goes, what do you think about doing a tour with Grantley Phillips? I was like, yeah, I'd love to. I've never met him, but I like him. And I was a fan of Grantley Buffalo. And he said, yeah, he wants to do it. And so it was like being set up on a blind date the first night. Like, I didn't know what it would really be like. And we instantly got along.
For sure. Yeah. My wife and I, we had a chance to see Grantley Buffalo play a reunion show in Chicago last year. I mean, it was great, you know, getting to see them after all these years. So it's, and he's got a, obviously you probably know, I mean, he's got a new record that's coming out that sounds great as well. So.
Yeah. No, the guy's amazing. And just a cool guy to hang with. So it's going to be fun again. We're like yin and yang of each other. I'm a lot more hyperactive. And, he's a little more reserved,
so,
but it works.
From the conversations that you guys have had, what's the plan for the shows as far as how it's going to go down each night?
One of us will go on first and play, and I think it's usually Grant going on first because I'm kind of really a bit wilder, and so it goes better with the flow. And what it is we have no dead air. So it's like he'll play like an hour and then instantly hand the baton off for me, and I come out and we'll do a couple songs together.
Cool.
And then I'll do an hour, and then I'll call him back out, and we'll do a couple more songs together. And so it's like a nonstop show of 2.5 hours of good music. And well, his music's good. I don't feel dumb saying that about mine, but his music's awesome. And I talk a lot more than he does, I think. Although he talks a lot.
Yeah, he does. Yep.
And he's super funny. And it worked really well with him going on first and then calling me out and us doing a couple songs together. I don't know if we'll stick with that format. I'm pretty easy. I'll go either way. I like going on first too.
Yeah, absolutely. And since you mentioned it, you mentioned playing a couple shows with the Ramones here in Cleveland. I have to ask you about that experience.
That was something I'll never forget because the promoter came in, and it was at the Blossom Music Center. Is
yep.
that like the outdoor amphitheater, the shed? And the promoter came back and said, and we were about to go on stage, and we were the band going on right before the Ramones. So there was a lot of bands on the bills. And he said, I want to apologize in advance on behalf of Ramones fans everywhere for what's about to happen to you. That's what the promoter said. I was like, what? And there was 10,000 people, right? That place holds a lot.
Yeah.
And it was packed. And it was like the Ramones' last tour, you know?
Yep.
And so I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, you'll probably get a lot of shit thrown at you, and they're not going to want to see you, but just persevere and have fun. And remember, you're opening for the Ramones. How cool is that? And so I walk out on stage, and I go, good evening, Cleveland. We're the Rugburns. Please, we came all the way from San Diego, California. Please give us a warm Cleveland welcome. And right away, this lemon came flying, and I could see it. And it's really weird to have someone throw a lemon at you from really far because you see it coming at you, and you almost become frozen and hypnotized by the lemon because you see it rotating, almost like a slow football or something. And the lemon's flying at me, and I'm like, oh, my God, there's a lemon coming right at my head. And I couldn't get out of the way. I was like a deer frozen in headlights. I've never forgotten this. And I lifted my guitar up to block the lemon, and it cracked my Taylor guitar, put a crack in it. And the lemon split open, and I picked it up and squeezed it all over my head for some reason. And then Stinky, our drummer, came running out, and he had a kilt on. And I lifted up his kilt and pushed him on the ground, and I squeezed the lemon all on his balls because he was spraying nothing under his kilt. And the crowd went nuts, and they loved it because we didn't have a hissy fit about it, you know?
Yeah, oh yeah.
And I said, that was a great shot. You cracked my guitar. Yeah! And then I just squeezed the lemon juice on his balls and then all over my face. And the crowd went nuts. And then we just rocked. And I swear to you, they loved us. Like, that was just one of the greatest memories, was playing for a crowd that big. And Hitchhiker Joe had been getting a lot of airplay, so a lot of people recognized it. And we had that song, Me and Eddie Vedder. And then we had Kilkenny Man. And Stinky was running around the stage in his kilt going nuts. And then we were supposed to get off stage. They said no one can be side stage when the Ramones play. And then Joey Ramone caught a little of our set and said it was okay if we stayed side stage. So we got to meet the Ramones, and we were the only band they let sit side stage, which was crazy. And I've also never forgotten this, because the Ramones don't take a break between songs. They just go, 1, 2, 3, 4, Sheena is a punk rocker, Sheena is a punk rocker now. And then the song ends, and like, 1, 2, 3, 4. Boom, boom, 24 hours ago, I want to be sedated. And Joey Ramone ran off stage halfway through the show and vomited in a trash can right next to me, like literally heaved. And I think he was sick with cancer, but he vomited and went right back on and kept singing. It was amazing. I was just blown away.
Wow.
And the set was so tight. It was so powerful to see the Ramones in their tight jeans, their leather jackets, and literally no dead air between songs. Just 1, 2, 3, 4. The quickest set of like probably 20 songs. You know, who knows how many, but every song I hit. It was the big leagues. and I was, my jaw was just agape.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting for you, like, because the Rugburns in their own way as well, I mean, they were legendary for playing these, like, really long shows that didn't let up from, like, the moment one to the end. So, I mean, it's got to be interesting to see a band like the Ramones that, like, does it the way you just described. But also, I mean, they were doing it that way for decades.
Yeah, and it was good for me to see that, because to this day, I've never used a set list. And it didn't matter how big the show was. Even still, as a solo artist, I could play huge festivals in Australia or in the U.S. where I'm going out and there's 5,000 people under a tent and I'm solo. And I still, to this day, don't even know what song I'm going to open with. And so it was neat to watch it. You'd see their set list and everything. And I remember the band was like, see, they have a set list. And I was like, I don't even know how to write a set list. I didn't even want to write one, because with the Rugburns, it was always about, I never wanted us to become complacent, and I never wanted them to know what was going to happen next, even the band. So sometimes I would even change the key to the song. And if we would normally do it in E, sometimes I'd just start doing it in G, and they'd have to follow. Because I'd be singing it higher, and I'd do it faster, I'd change the tempo. And they'd or I'd just make up a song on the spot, and they go, I've never even heard what you're playing. And they'd start following me, because they go, oh, he's making up a song. And they'd listen to the changes, and we'd have this chorus written. And because I always felt like if I'm excited on stage, then that is contagious, and the crowd will feel it. And to this day, I still believe that. So if I'm laughing on stage at something, and I'm seeming surprised, it's not an act. It's because I just shocked myself, because I'm like going, I can't believe what's going on. So it makes it really fun, and that's something that is undeniably will affect an audience in a way where that you really get them.
Where did the idea eventually to branch out solo come from? How much was that an extension of, like, the songwriting success you'd had with the Jewel hit?
I remember we were playing in Indianapolis, and that was another one of our big cities.
Yeah.
For some reason, the Rugburns did really, we were really adopted by the Midwest. We became like a Rust Belt band in a way, you know, like Dayton, Ohio, and Chicago loved us, and Champaign, different areas. And I remember we were playing in Indianapolis, and man, the people would get so drunk. And I had written some soft song called I Love Everything About You, and I wanted to do it. This is the whole thing of never using a set list. And I remember I was doing it, and it was just like wrong time to do it. So, like, if you live by not doing a set list, you also die by not using a set list, because I wanted to do whatever was new to me. And so I remember I was singing the song I Love Everything About You, and people, like, during the whole song, were going, Dick's Automotive! Dick's Automotive! That was what they wanted to hear. And I remember thinking, I don't want to keep playing in a dress and playing Dick Simon. I want to try this now. And then Rob Driscoll wanted to go back teaching. So he did. So we continued on as a trio. And then it had just kind of run its course. And I put out a solo record, and I got really into creating that way. And Gregory had quit the band and went solo. So we replaced him with John Castro, which was really cool. And that was like one of my favorite times too, is when we were just a trio.
Yeah.
Everybody had quit, and it was me, Stinky, and John Castro. And I still think it's a really good lineup like that. It was really tight. And sometimes I regret not having kept it alive, because had I wanted to keep it alive, like better alive, like never let it die, I could have. Like, we still play some gigs, but had I kept it alive, I wonder just how big we would have been. And if, but I don't think I would have been as happy, because I wanted to do other things, and I wanted to, like, tell stories on stage. And I saw myself getting older, and I didn't want to just be wearing a dress on stage singing Sweet Transvestite. Even though I still love doing that, I wanted to be able to go and be sort of more of a raconteur and tell stories and make people laugh and add to the comedic side and do a mellow song, a crazy song, and see if I could continue on in this And I think the other thing was I saw a guy named Loudon Wainwright, the third play. And I was like, I saw my future. And I went to see him at McCabe's in Santa Monica, which is funny because I'm now playing at McCabe's in February. And I remember when I went to McCabe's, I drove up from San Diego, and McCabe's is in Santa Monica. And I went to see Loudon Wainwright, and I went, man, if I could just do that. That was before the Rugburns were touring. We were just playing in a bar. And I just thought, that would be so cool to be like Loudon Wainwright when I get older and be able to just get on stage, tell stories, make people cry, make them laugh, and be really irreverent. And I just thought, I could do that. I can't do it yet, but I can do that, what he's doing. I know I can. It was like I saw my future. And so now when I go back to McCabe's, it'll be my second time playing there. It's just like, it really means a lot to me because I go, I remember when I saw my future there. And I just played a show with Loudon Wainwright in Dallas, Texas recently, and I told him that story, which was pretty cool.
What was it about what you saw from Loudon that, you know, really stuck out as, like, where you wanted to go to?
That he was able to hold an audience all on his own.
Yeah.
And tell stories and take this journey. And he was able to finger pick on the guitar and you could hear it. And he wasn't just thrashing about, which I love doing too at the Rugburns. I mean, I don't mean any disrespect to that because I still love that. But it was like a lot of that with the Rugburns, I couldn't even hear my acoustic guitar. Like I'd have electric guitar over it. I'd be breaking strings, running around. It was frenetic. And I still love it to this day. I love the Rugburns. And I keep thinking I want to do a tour and really see what would happen, like give it a full year of working on it, another record, and do that. But what I saw in Loudon was he was able to do it all on his own. And as much as I love the Rugburns, being in a band can kind of be a drag too, because it's like you have three other people besides yourself that you need to worry about. And where do you want to eat? I don't know. Where do you want to eat? You become like brothers, and there can be horrible times too where you guys are just all hating each other and you just think, God, I'm like a slave to this. And when I saw Loudon, I go, man, he just travels alone and he's just this troubadour playing these small clubs, and that's all I really wanted. I didn't have visions of grandeur. Like, to me, to be able to play McCabe's and be in my 50s would be awesome, and be able to play all the McCabe's guitar shops in the US, Australia, and Canada would even be better. And that's kind of what I'm doing, and playing all these folk festivals.
Yeah, it seemed like, certainly starting with when you put out the Chinese Vacation record, it seems like you've been able to like kind of call your own shots from that point forward.
Yeah, I have a new record that I'll bring to Cleveland. It's called Folk Singer.
Oh, cool.
And it's brand new, and I got to put it up online on like my own label and everything. And so I remember when I got dropped from Mercury Records, I think I sold like 70,000 records, and that was like an epic failure on a major label. Whereas if I could sell 70,000 a day, that would be huge.
Yep.
But it was back in the day when 70,000 records wasn't anything. And so I got dropped. My A&R person left. I'm glad I went through all that, because it's really neat to have been, you know, with the Rugburns, we were signed to Frank Zappa's early label, Bizarre Planet Records, and then we got signed to Priority, which was NWA's label they were on. So when I saw that movie about NWA, I was like, I know exactly that building. We went in there, we were signed to the same label when that stuff was blowing up huge, and Priority Records started an alternative rock division and signed us. Then I got a solo record deal on a huge label. So I got to, I'm really lucky that I got to do all that and have a hit song with Jewel and travel the world. Yet the funny thing is I'm still doing it, and I just do it on my own. And it's cool doing it on your own, but it's also a drag, because if you don't do the work, nothing gets done. And sometimes you just don't want to do it, you know?
Yeah.
It just becomes a hassle.
So what's the vibe with this new record?
Oh man, I'm really into it. I can send you it. I'll just send you the songs via email. It'll be like 13 different emails.
Cool. All right.
I don't have it on a Dropbox, but it's called Folk Singer, and it's the first record I've made in San Diego in years where I live. And I picked this guy named Jeff Berkeley, who really did a good job, and he's seen me play over the years. He's in a band called Berkeley Heart. He's made literally hundreds of records in San Diego, and he's got a really sensitive ear. And he was just like, let's make a real acoustic-y, folky record. I said, okay, yeah, I have a song called Folk Singer, and I want to put it out. And so it's got a real, I think you're going to like it. It's got a really cool vibe to it.
I was interested to see what was going on with you musically because, I mean, the last record that you put out, The Accident, was kind of the same thing where it's just like all of a sudden you had a new record. So I figured that you might have some sort of new record about the drop. So that's exciting to hear about this Folk Singer record.
Yeah, it's I'm really happy with it. And I think Jeff Berkley did a great job.
One of the things here in the past couple of years that was, a big surprise was to, log on to, Facebook one day and all of a sudden see that you'd had a stroke. So how have things been for you, since that point?
Really good. It's been amazing. I feel fantastic and, super healthy.
Yeah.
And really grateful to be alive, more appreciative. And definitely, I think I thought I was immortal, and now I realize I'm not.
Yeah.
I really thought I was. I just thought nothing would happen to me. And then that happened to me, and I couldn't believe it. I still can't believe it happened because I just don't have time for that. I quit the job I had years ago. I had a job, and I remember once I quit it, it seemed like I've really done nothing but work. And I guess when you start working for yourself, you work harder. But I don't think work caused it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Some people would say it did, so I have no idea why it happened, but I somehow got a blood clot back there in my head, and it worked its way out, but it made me go blind, and then it was really bizarre because it just kind of made me a little bit like I was dazed.
Yeah.
And but it was actually good things come of that, because had I not had the stroke, I would have never gotten into the Grateful Dead.
Really?
And yeah, I had the stroke, and I never listened to the Dead before, and then I got in a car, and it had XM radio, and I didn't even know the Dead had their own channel, but their channel 23, and I put it on, or it was on in the car, I went, Grateful Dead channel on Sirius XM, and then all of a sudden, in my dazed state, the music made sense, and now, I listen to so much Dead. I never listened to them at all. I was just it didn't even exist in my world. I had seen a couple Dead shows back in the day, and I didn't hate them or anything. It's just I never was drawn to it. And now I love it. I always have it on that station, and it all makes sense to me.
That's an interesting side effect to come out of something like that, you know?
I had a stroke and got into the Dead. I don't know why. I think it's so funny.
So one of the first things you did when you started going back on the road is you went out and opened some shows for Mike and the Mechanics. How did those gigs come about?
Oh, yeah. He's booked by the same agent as me. And they wanted me to do the whole tour. And it was a drag because I had a huge Australia tour. And so I had to tell Mike Rutherford and the gang I could only do a few of the dates. I was going to do 30 dates across the U.S. And I wish I could have, because he is so nice and their crew is so nice. And it was a five-star tour, which a lot of times I'm just playing little clubs, but this was catered food and the whole deal. But I was playing some really good festivals in Australia and I didn't want to miss those. So I told them I couldn't do the whole tour. So but it was really cool because I got to bond a little bit with him. I was never a huge Genesis fan, so it was neat to I immersed myself in a little bit of their music and got kind of into it. It was neat to hear him play some of those songs and hear that and see these diehard Genesis fans, because it's amazing the people that show up for that are, they bring all these old records and they want them to sign them, and I like anybody who has a history that's weathered the years in the trenches on the road in this business that we have. Like, I have mad respect for anybody who does it, you know. And I'm always fascinated when I see there's all these little niches and genres and stuff where I didn't even know people had followings in a certain type of music. And it's really cool.
Well, you mentioned Australia, and that was something that I read as I was reading about the health issues that you had had. I mean, it's pretty staggering that the thing that I saw mentioned was that you had performed 38 nights in a row with no break in Australia. And I think we sometimes get kind of stuck in our United States bubble here, but that's pretty incredible to visualize that you can tour that extensively in Australia.
It's nuts, man. And the shows, like, are packed. A lot of them are sold out, and they're so happy that you made that trek all the way down there. And it's a beautiful thing to be able to do this for a living. And you're right, we do get stuck in our own bubble, and there's such a world out there of places to play. Same with Canada. Canada, you know, years ago I wasn't even playing Canada, and it's really been a great market for me. That the whole country has been really good to me there too, Australia and Canada.
So how did you go about, like where did, like, the Australia thing, like, where did those international pockets kind of start developing? Like, was that kind of a gradual thing? Because it seems like initially there'd be kind of a leap of faith, you know, obviously you taking the trip to go, you know, wherever you're going to go and play the shows. Like, it doesn't seem like you necessarily do something like that and go somewhere and have instant success. So there is, it seems like there would be some sort of gamble involved.
Australia came about because I went there with Jewel when she was on the Spirit tour. I think she had a record out called Spirit, and we were her band, and she had this amazing band. Doug Pettibone on electric guitar, who has played with Lucinda Williams and John Mayer, and he's played with everybody. He's really good. He was electric. I was playing acoustic guitar. Brady Blade on drums. He's amazing. He's played with so many different people. He was with Steve Roland, the Dukes, and all these different people. Brady's great. His brother's a famous jazz drummer named Brian Blade. Steve George on piano, and he was in that band Mister.
Oh yeah, totally.
Crazy, yeah. And he wrote that song Kyrie Eleison, and he wrote Take These Broken Wings. And he's such a cool guy. I'd love to see him again. I haven't seen him in a long time. And then on bass was Tony Hall. So Tony and Brady were just like this awesome rhythm section. Tony Hall played in the Funky Meters, and he played on Bob Dylan's, some Bob Dylan records that Daniel Lanois produced. And Tony's just amazing. And so that band was really fun. So we went to Australia, and I got to open for her there. And that's what first brought me to Australia. And I opened the shows, and they were sold out in theaters. And I went over really well in Sydney and Melbourne. So I was like, I think I should go back. And then now I've gone there since then 15 times. And so going with Jewel was the first reason I went there. And then I went back on my own, and I had to just build my own crowd then.
Nice.
Because what I've learned over the years is, and I think this holds true for anybody, but it's a big lesson to learn, is you could go and open for somebody, but it really doesn't do a lot like what you'd think. Like, you could have a hit song with somebody, and somebody could say, wrote hit song. Nobody really cares. And then you open for somebody, and maybe a couple people will be converts and come see you. But what really gets people and builds a following is just hard work and going there and doing it and making it your own show. And when you do that, those people become your fans, and they'll go to battle for you. And so I think you got to just keep touring and doing your road work. And the more you do that, the better it gets for you if you have something to offer. Because now I know when I go to Australia, I think there's probably only three people that are coming to the shows that saw me back in the day with Jewel. And the rest have all been because I've gone there and worked and stuff.
That's really cool. I mean, but that's something that, I mean, well, obviously on the one side of things, that gives you, you obviously have confidence in your material when you see stuff like that, you know, knowing that your material has the goods.
Hopefully, yeah, I feel like I can go and play a festival or open for even Mike and the Mechanics or anything and hopefully connect with a segment of the audience. The more I do this, the more I feel like I can walk out on stage and kind of read the room and read the energy and see what I need to do. And I think you hopefully, if you're doing it long enough, you get better at it and build your own fan base and keep selling records. It's kind of fun. I just like building it. Like, I always feel like the career keeps going up, and that's good. Like, it always has room for growth. I still don't feel like I'm on my way down yet. And once that starts happening, I think that I would be a little bummed if I went, wow, this is not working anymore at all, and it's going down. But I feel like there's always room for improvement, and I'm still climbing the ladder. And I haven't peaked yet, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It absolutely does. And you talk about like reading the room. It seems like you've always been good at like, say, working a room. Is that something that you felt like you had pretty early on, or is that something that you know, really had to kind of develop in San Diego when you were, you know, playing shows at that point?
That came from playing a lot of shows to a lot of drunks in a lot of pubs. And and making a lot of mistakes. And so playing in San Diego, I had to learn to do that because the pubs I was playing in were packed. And there would be a lot of people in there. And I noticed if there was dead air, people would start screaming out, like, play some Skynyrd or something. You know, we were just learning how to work a room. And if I broke a string, what I needed to do to remedy that situation, can I change the string and keep talking? Can I keep the show going? And going, oh, no, I've done too many slow songs in a row. I think a lot of times when you're younger and you're just getting started, you haven't learned how to read it yet and feel the energy and where to take the room. And so you have to go to school by doing the shows. It's like the whole school of hard knocks thing. Like, it's not something you could go to college and learn. You have to learn it from doing it. And there was such a random selection of people that would come see us back when we started in San Diego. And we started as a cover band, you know, like on a college campus. First thing we learned, the Rugburns as a duo, was a Beatles medley. That was like our big thing to do in the show. We had a Beatles medley. And we just started getting this vibe together, and then we started writing songs. We wrote some together, and then we would write them separately. And then I just went on a writing tear and realized that pretty soon, you know, at first it was like, maybe one or two originals, and then it was like 10 originals, and then it was like maybe 80-20, 80% covers, 20% originals, and then slowly 70-30, then 50-50, and now it's like the other way around, you know, 90% originals. And I always love doing covers, so I'll never not do a show and not do some song that I'm into. Just that's how you learn about writing, is from learning songs. And lately, I've been learning all these really cool Grateful Dead songs and going through this whole, and a lot of John Hartford songs. And there's just so many cool songs out there that you can throw in your show.
Yeah, and I would imagine that, like, the crowds that you were playing to in those early days, like the drunks and stuff like that, that has to kind of affect the tone of the songwriting of the songs that you're writing at that point. Does that feed into, like, you know, the songs you were coming up with, like a Dick's Automotive and all that stuff?
Yeah, kind of like, it's kind of like evolution. Like, I always think of it like the monster from the lagoon that rose out of some toxic sludge, like from being in a bar. And I'm talking back being in a bar when people could smoke and they would drink a lot, and it would be hot and sweaty, and we would just be playing these shows and become this creature from the Black Lagoon, if you will. Like, you rise from the sludge and out of this dystopian world that you're playing in. And it really is kind of a dystopian world, like drunks at the bar in some dive bar, and you come in and you're like, how can I get these people's attention? They just want to hear Steve Miller Band play Joker. And so how can I go from playing a song like that and the Joker, I better write a strong song that's going to keep their attention. So at first it's like a lot of really goofy songs, something funny to grab their attention, and then weirder songs, and then really pushing the limits and seeing what works and seeing what doesn't work, and then pretty love songs, just whatever I felt like writing. And then I always knew I tapped into something if I wrote a song and I thought, I can't play this for these people. And I go, that'd be a challenge. Like, yes, you can. The other voice would say it. No, it's going to offend a lot of people. Who cares? Just do it. And then I'd do it. And people go on the break, what was that one song? That was so cool. And that would get, that's the booster shot you need as a songwriter to continue to know that you're on your path, is if somebody comes up and goes, I noticed you played a song. It was really cool. It said something about single life. I liked it. I remember the first time I did that song was at Kelly's Pub. I was like, you liked that? And I really cornered the person. Why did you like it? I said, I don't know. It just was really honest. It was funny and it was cool. Right? Who wrote it? And I was like, I wrote it. And they go, wow. And then that's all you need, that booster shot for the night. You think, hey, this worked. This connected with somebody. It resonated. So I'm going to write another song. Oh, it's not as easy as I thought it was. This one isn't working. And then back to the drawing board, trying it again through trial and error. But I always say that if you don't have a place to try out your wares, then you don't really know if they're going to work. So you need an audience. And I was lucky enough that we were playing every Saturday night at Kelly's Pub, and we were able to go. I'd go, hey, here's another new song I wrote. And sometimes people were like, eh. And then other times it really connected. And it hurts when people don't like it because they're the song, they're like your creation. But then you get, your skin gets thicker and you're like, well, who cares? Here's another one. And then a lot of times the audience is wrong and I stick with it and eventually they get it. And now it's another lesson to learn. You know, like, they're going to get it. It's just they're not ready for it yet. They need to hear it more. Like, I can't just let this song die. It'll be good as an album track, and then people will eventually request it. Like, it's kind of a big mystery to me still.
Well, I guess since you mentioned the Dead, what are some of your favorite Dead songs to play right now?
I'm kind of into the real popular stuff still, but I'm listening to a lot of the live versions of it. So I'm really loving Uncle John's Band. I like the Robert Hunter lyrics of Ripple. I play Ripple. I'm so into that song. I think it's beautiful. And I like when the Dead does Dylan, the song When I Paint My Masterpiece.
Mm-hmm.
I love the band doing it too. So I'm really into that. I saw Dylan and the Dead back in the day when they toured together. And I like Broke Down Palace. I think that's a great song. And obviously Casey Jones is so cool. I never get sick of that song. I love it. I like the way that the verse goes. The way he says, this old engine makes it on time. It goes from the C to the D to the F to the G. I just like the C to the D lift because it's like, this old engine makes it on time. When you switch to the D chord and then back to that, Lee Central Station, about a quarter to nine. And then does it again, hits River Junction, back to, from the C to the D, 17-2. And then the F to the A minor at a quarter to 10. You know, it's F to the A minor to the E to the G, E7 to the G, traveling again. And then back to C, 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 F, driving that train high on cocaine. I love it. And I've been doing that with this friend of mine named Sean Rolfe, and he does the harmony so well on that and plays the lead really good. And then he plays mandolin on Ripple, which is really cool. And so I've been, there's so many other songs that are way cooler as you get into it and you see the different versions of them, and you just go, man, I got to learn this. I want to learn this. And it's so funny to look out at the audience and realize how many people were into those songs.
Oh, yeah.
And there's deadheads everywhere. And then they come up and they're like, so happy that you played that. And the cool thing about Deadheads are, because I love punk rock too. I love punk rock, and especially the melodic punk rock and the real good lyrical punk rock, like especially Paul Westerberg, all the Replacement stuff. Like that was I call it my college, was going to school on the Replacements, kind of like as a songwriter, listening to nothing but Replacements and Husker Du, and especially like funny bands too, like the Dead Milkmen, Mojo Nixon, who we got to tour with. You know, we toured with Mojo. And so I love all that school too. But I was never that into the Dead, probably because I loved the punk and indie world, and it was like anathema to the punk world to say that if you were into the Dead. And so now that I realize, as you get older, you can like whatever you want. You just don't care anymore. I don't care whether it's cool or not. And so I realize how many people are into the Dead. And I know what I was going to say. You're never going to get a Deadhead who's going to be, I mean, maybe you will. I could be wrong, but you really don't get too many dickhead Dead fans. Like, they're really mellow. I'm like, hey, brother, they're hippies. They're just kind of stoked. And so if you're doing a Dead song and paying homage to it and not taking the piss out of it, they're really honored that you did that. And you meet all these cool people and they start going, oh, you need to listen to this show from 1978. That was the best year. And blah, blah, blah. Listen to this show in San Francisco. And I'm getting sucked into this whole wormhole of all these songs, you know, China Cat, I Know You Rider, and all these other Dead songs that I'm getting into.
And now that you've said that, you're going to go on a string of meeting nothing but asshole Dead fans.
Probably. I really don't think you meet too many dickhead ones, but I could be wrong. But the ones I meet are, like, really nice. Kind of like I say about pot smokers. A pot smoker really doesn't go out and get in a fist fight. Like, if somebody's just a pot smoker and they wake up every day, you're probably not going to get in a fist fight with that dude. But a meth head drinking tequila, look out. I don't even drink anymore or anything, but it's funny because I could be wrong with all this. It's just where my head's at now. And I just think I've met some really cool Deadheads, and I've been playing a lot of these hippie festivals, and they're really fun too. Like, the whole folk world and hippie world is a world I wasn't really in. And now I'm playing like a lot of these folk fests, and I'm coming at it with a attitude of somebody who was in this crazy rock band, Rugburns, who was, like, I was playing naked on stage some nights, you know, or with a sock over my dick, pretending I was in the Chili Peppers. Like, just the crazy shit we used to do. And so coming into this jam band world and playing these festivals and folk festivals, I'm kind of a wild card. And it's actually fun because I'm not censoring myself. I'm still doing what I do. But for whatever reason, the whole world has become, in a way, less genre specific and more of a hodgepodge, melting pot of music. And as we sift through the Great American Songbook and the Great World Songbook, you look at stuff, you can basically do whatever you want. That's what's so cool about today. You can write a song, put it up on YouTube, and go, hey, check out this song, everybody. Or just some weird thought that you want to write about and just put it up on Facebook or wherever on your blog, and you can connect with a lot of people. You can just ask a question. And we didn't get to do that. We used to have to send out postcards, and then they'd come back, and they'd have our dates on them where we were playing, and then at the last minute, some club would add a date, and they'd go, we just went to Kinko's and got these postcards made. Shit! They just put stamps on them. They'd cut the stamps off of the postcards and tape them on somehow and have a cassette release party. Like, it was all fun, too. That's all part of the journey, like our cassette release parties and everything. Now cassettes are hip again. That's what's so funny. But it's a crazy journey to have been in the music business and seen the business kind of get decimated and rebuilt to what it is now.
Yeah, because I'm sure that at the time that you guys were, you know, coming around with the Rugburns, I mean, it already felt pretty challenging then, but it seems like, for the social media opportunities and other things that you have now, it's like there were, on the music industry side, perhaps a lot of opportunities that you guys had when you were doing the Rugburns that do not exist now.
Oh, yeah. Back then, there were like a lot of in-stores and record stores, you know?
Yeah.
So there were
yeah.
so many record stores. We go, oh, we have an in-store at 3. We got a meet and greet. Then we got the show. Then we've got to get over here. Oh, our pager's going off. We'd have to go to a payphone, call into our management. From the payphone, do we have enough quarters? Who's got directions to the show? I wrote them on the back of that napkin from Denny's. Oh, yeah. Okay, there they are. The club gave us bad directions. Just all the different things, like the ways of being on the road. And there was good and bad. And the one thing I know, though, is you can't fight the change. And
yep.
just tell you can't. I mean, you can, but you look stupid, you know, standing on the corner going, you guys need to use a typewriter. Why are you guys using computers? Or you kids stop listening to music streaming on Spotify and buy this record. Like, it's not going to do you any good. Change just keeps coming, and it will always, that's what's always going to happen. Who knows what, how people will be listening to music in 20 more years. All I know is it's going to always be in a state of change.
Well, final couple things here. First of all, there was talk at one point a few years ago that you were going to do a record with Glenn Tilbrook. Is that still somewhere on the table?
That would be great. I just need to make time to get back over to England. I've been really lax about getting back there in the last couple of years, and I need to get back to London. I think the reason is because my booking agent that I have books me in Australia, Canada, and the U.S., and they keep me so busy. I wish they booked Europe and the U.K., because if they did, they would just have it in their system. So it's up to me to make time and call up Glenn Tilbrook's wife, Suzanne, and she books my tours over there and go, hey, I want to come over and I want to make that record with Glenn.